I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Integration is something we think of as way back in the past when high schools combined white and black students in classrooms and Jim Crow laws were finally abolished. Today we talk with an economist to learn the importance of integration today and how modern integration efforts could benefit students down the line. Then, some say it's a man's world. Maybe that's because history has largely failed to acknowledge the women who have wielded power. We'll hear about the influence of some ancient female leaders in Egypt and learn the political lessons they have to teach us. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. If you want to improve the prospects of black and Hispanic children, desegregate public schools. That's the premise of Rucker Johnson's new book, Children of the Dream, Why School Integration Works. Johnson advocates a three-tiered strategy to counter racism and social inequality. Those three: integrated schools, school finance reform, and high-quality preschool. He writes this: if mediocre education threatens the nation, then achieving integrated classrooms is nothing less than a fight for our collective future that we can and must win. We're about to find out how this squares with Kansas City's own history that includes a school desegregation case that proved to be a massive failure in the minds of many. Rucker Johnson is the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and Faculty Research Associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. His focus is on the role of poverty and inequality in one's prospects in life. Professor, it's nice to have you. Welcome to Up to Date.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
You begin this book by acknowledging something we've talked about on this program any number of times, and that is that it appears today like the landmark Supreme Court ruling Brown versus Board of Education from just down the road in Topeka never happened because our schools are more segregated than they have been in decades. That's certainly the case in Kansas City. What happened?
So I think the one important thing is that it's been off the radar. And It's very important to understand that this didn't happen by coincidence, that it's a direct result of direct policy decisions, a series of court cases and policy decisions at the federal level. Federal level have, you know, restricted the powers of policymakers at all levels to combat contemporary educational segregation. And this both between districts and between schools within districts. And yet, it's really the release of court-ordered desegregation and the retrenchment and return to school segregation and the nature of school segregation today, two-thirds of it actually occurs between districts rather than within districts. So new policy levers that include housing policy must be part of the solution to address many of the issues that relate to educational opportunity for all kids in our public school systems today.
I was going to say, you're talking about a multifaceted approach here. There's no magic wand waving here that one thing is going to resolve this issue once and for all.
Yeah, and I think a big part of it is a better understanding of why integration matters and what aspects of educational opportunity are affected by segregation. We're not just talking about segregation of students, but it's actually the cutting off in the hoarding of opportunity that creates systems where lower income and minority children are often confined to overcrowded schools with larger class sizes, with less experienced teachers. We're having significant issues with a lack of teacher diversity and with very few opportunities for high quality pre-K that often have to be coupled together with the school funding reforms for integration efforts to have the long run impacts that we find in our work.
Why are you so convinced that school integration is so important? Why is it such a powerful answer to a lot of things that ail us?
So there's a number of aspects that we found, and this is partly by really looking at the entire history and the long-run impacts of school integration efforts, because a lot of the kind of conventional wisdom has played to a narrative that we tried integration for a long period of time, when in fact there's only a 15-year window in which significant integration efforts occurred. So what we did is try to construct an entire case inventory and nationally representative evidence to follow kids from birth to adulthood. And what we discovered when we contextualized the school conditions and school quality and access to opportunity that kids had is when they had access to quality pre-K investments, and then they were subsequently gained access to quality funded schools, which often happened in more integrated environments, because what integration did in part was to reallocate school resources, facilities, and after-school programs, and teacher quality, and that access, and bridged some of those divides across both race and socioeconomic status. And we find that when that occurred, all children's outcomes improved from that increase in improved access, particularly lower-income minority children.
You know, ultimately, you say we gave up on the whole desegregation effort too quickly, right?
Yeah, so, you know, and this is actually where Missouri's case actually plays a role, that beginning in the early 90s, there became a significant shift in the a series of Supreme Court decisions and changes in the federal administrative priorities began to significantly limit the frequency and scope of federal desegregation orders. And in fact, the case in 1995 that involved Kansas City was the case of Jenkins, Missouri versus Jenkins. Mm-hmm. And before that, this is decided in 1995, but before that, the state was required to correct de facto racial inequality in schools by funding teacher salary increases and a variety of remedial education programs to improve the quality of education programs, particularly in otherwise segregated environments. And so the argument in before this Missouri versus Jenkins overruled that was that to end segregation in the schools, the district needed higher paid quality teachers. Mm-hmm. And so it ordered a range of quality education programs, from grants to schools, magnet programs, facility improvements. And those actually are a big part of why school resources matter so much for the learning opportunities and environments for children. And so once that was lifted, you know, the segregation of lower income versus middle class children and more fluent children increased, the racial segregation increased. And this isn't just in Missouri, but it's a pattern that we find all across the country. And so those are things that are significantly harming student outcomes, which is the whole point of why both I'm passionate about the issue, but why the evidence is so important to stay connected with.
Rucker Johnson is my guest. His new book, Children of the Dream, Why School Integration Works. You write this: simply put, a nation that can place a human being on the moon can figure out how to teach algebra to middle schoolers in Baltimore. You're saying we can get past this.
We certainly can. And, you know, what's interesting is that we actually were making significant headway. And so part of it is that there is a narrative that school spending doesn't have lasting impacts on kids' outcomes, that pre-K investments have fade out and basically their benefits don't last beyond third grade, or that desegregation was a failed social experiment. And in fact, it's very much the opposite of that, that segregation has proven to, there are very few highly concentrated poverty schools that have consistently beat the odds and, you know, had great student outcomes. And a part of that concentration of poverty in schools is that it affects the ability to attract the highest quality teachers. Mm. And part of that is because those schools are often underfunded, under-resourced, and they're teaching kids that have some of the greatest needs with regard to special education, with regard to limited English language proficiency, and other related issues around poverty. So those are important things to consider.
You know, I want to go back to something that I've noticed myself over the years when it comes to education, and that is this notion of how utterly impatient we are as a society when it comes to wanting to see improvements there and see them quickly. You write this, we implement some new whiz-bang reform, let it run its course for a little while, but then become impatient because things haven't improved as much as we wanted them to. You say we need to slow down and just chill a bit. Give me an example of this impatience you're talking about.
Well, I think there's a good urgency about the importance of school reforms that work and make them and that commitment to be done. But the myopic focus on short-run test scores, I actually think is misguided, and it's also causing us to abandon major reforms that are actually leading to improvements in leadership capacity and other learning outcomes, non-cognitive skills and stick-to-itiveness. There's aspects of the learning environment that are just missed by exclusive focus on short-run test scores. And so we really try to shift the way we examine the long-run efficacy of access to school quality by looking at high school graduation rates, looking at test scores, but also looking at college going rates, college completion rates. And what we find is those translate significantly into earnings and show the power that schools play in being able to break the intergenerational cycle of poverty, but not when those are policies that are done intermittently, turned off and on, but rather that when they're sustained throughout the pre-K through 12 years, that's when we see what we call a dose response. So you can think of like a school system that's underfunded is having a type of ailment that doesn't allow high quality programs to be sustained. The treatment is both integration and school funding reform. And the longer you're exposed to the dose of that treatment and that exposure, we find the bigger boost that we find in improvements in long-term outcomes for kids that really more than pay for themselves in the form of reduced criminal involvement in adulthood, significant improvements in earnings that are really long lasting.
You know, do a lot of educational researchers in your universe, do they agree with you?
I have to say, there's certainly an increasing surge of research that's showing the prominence of school resources and school spending on improving student outcomes. But that's actually against a backdrop of 30 years of studies that have often suggested that school spending doesn't matter.
Certainly, I was going to say, you know, in our neck of the woods, school funding in the state of Kansas has been an ongoing and a huge issue. And conservatives have argued forcefully for years that more school spending doesn't always equate to better outcomes. And they've got studies to prove it.
Yeah. So part of it is that, you know, you do have to have rigorous research designs. I'm not going to get into a statistical conversation, but certainly it really does matter that you really are able to isolate the impacts of schools as apart from family background and other community deficits that many of the schools are facing. So you really do have to account for those other disadvantages that some communities and lower income families experience so that you can really isolate the impacts of schools. But the one thing I want to kind of emphasize here is this is not a zero-sum game. People kind of approach this as one in which the benefits for minority children or low-income children are somehow coming at the expense of more affluent or and white children.
Right.
Actually, that is very much not what we find in the data. We find
that white kids don't give up anything is what you write in the book.
Exactly. And moreover, there is important aspects of exposure to diversity and what we call the art of thinking individually together, that what diversity brings in a school system of diverse perspectives and experiences in ways in which, particularly with teacher diversity as an important component, can really boost children's learning opportunities as well.
Let's go back to the Brown versus Board of Education ruling again. It's locally based out of Topeka here, ending separate but equal schools. You know, before that ruling came down, had any progress toward desegregation in public schools taken place, you know, in the years even going back to the Civil War?
Yeah, so, you know, the NAACP had a very long and rigorous strategy around how they were going to bring the case to bear. And so many people think of it as like, a single case of Topeka, Kansas, but it actually, Brown represented five different plaintiffs from five mm-hmm. different cities and states. And what they were trying to bring is the force of a national representative set of cases that have that even still have contemporary relevance today. And a big part of this, I think, is that the judicial landmarks of the school desegregation cases actually also provided some of the litigation foundation for the school funding reform cases. So where school desegregation aimed to kind of address by redistributing school children, the school funding reforms did it by redistributing resources and money. Mm-hmm. And the pre-K investments that I'm really emphasizing are redistributing the timing of the investments back to the earliest years of cognitive development. And it's really the combination of the three that hold the keys to unlocking equal educational opportunity for all children. I want to just make one additional point, which is that in cities, this is something that we really emphasize in the book, is that in cities such as Charlotte and Birmingham and Memphis, there's been a significant rise in secessions of more affluent districts breaking off from the rest of the community that have had really big impacts on school funding disparities, because more than 45% of school budgets typically come from local property taxes in the U.S. And mm-hmm. as a result of the high income families seceding from their school districts, it's really drained funding and worsen segregation for the lower income and middle class children left behind. So this issue of secession, increasing levels of poverty and segregation is again a policy induced phenomena that can be reversed, but not if we are not serious in our attention to be proactive to further the goals of school integration.
Yeah. You know, one of the points you make about the Brown case is that a lot of people believe even today that there, you know, the Brown ruling came down the pike and it was like a light switch being flipped and that schools suddenly went from being segregated to integrated, just lickety split. You say that wasn't the reality at all. And I'm wondering why not? Because, you know, after all, the highest court in the land had spoken and spoken pretty clearly here.
Yeah. So they laid out clearly that segregation in apartheid schools was unconstitutional, but the remedy and the means to achieve integration was left for the actual and the implementation and nature of that was left for the school districts to implement. And the design of that created a lot of room for white resistance at that time. So in the first decade after Brown, as Walter Gellhorn, a legal scholar, poetically and aptly described it, that the pace of integration in the first decade after Brown was one of a extraordinarily arthritic snail.
Yeah. I was going to go to a story you tell early in the book about the resistance to the Brown ruling that I had never heard this before. It was 1963, 9 years after the ruling came down. Mm-hmm. And you take us into a bedroom of two little boys, 11 and 10, in the middle of the night.
Mm. Mr. Armstrong, yes.
Yeah, what was going on in that room and where did that take place?
So this is Birmingham, Alabama.
Right.
And we had just the great fortune to interview really living pioneers of integration. And I think one of the things that really informed the work was not just the kind of longer run quantitative data where we assembled data from nationally represented following kids from birth to adulthood across three generations, but it was the qualitative interviews with people like Mr. Armstrong, whose father was a leader in the civil rights movement and partnered with Martin Luther King Jr. and served on the school board that led the school litigation efforts toward integration in Birmingham. And, you know, their family was part of the 16th Street church bombing. They had extended family members that certainly knew of the family involved in that. And they told many cases in which, you know, their threats of, you know, in firebombs. So it's a very contentious history. But I think what I found remarkable is that in spite of all that they faced in terms of opposition, their resolute and commitment to the integration efforts and ensuring that their children have access to integrated and high quality educational environments, I think was actually an eye opening and really inspired me to continue this work. To just hear their lived testimony of what impact it had on them.
There was a woman sitting in that room with a shotgun or something on her lap, just keeping eyes on those kids throughout the night to making sure nothing happened to them in terms of violence against them to stop them from going to a integrated school.
Yes, and President Kennedy had ordered that they be accompanied to school each
yes.
and every day. It's unfortunate that
by U.S. Marshals and school was only a block away.
Yes, and yeah. that was necessary for them to be safe. It's just a part of that history that has to be told.
Yeah.
But it's more than a history. It's really about the march for equal opportunity extends today, and that we have to not have the kind of policy amnesia to not recognize the warriors that led the effort. And we can't afford to allow the kind of backslidden into segregated schools mm-hmm. where kids then it reinforces prejudice and stereotype. And, you know, what we document is the connection between school segregation is directly related also to the polarization of political attitudes, the racial animus, the surges in racial prejudice that we've seen. We're able to connect that back to children's early life experiences, to integration, diversity versus highly segregated school systems, where these attitudes are often cultivated or reinforced.
Rucker Johnson's my guest. His book, Children of the Dream, Why School Integration Works. Let's look forward, because you say that solving school desegregation will require what you call renewed attention to several entrenched problems at once. You've mentioned them here today, but let's run them through them one at a time. The first is housing policy. Even you admit it can seem like a futile task to undo housing segregation. What do you see as a path forward here?
So I think what's important is that mixed income housing developments and having policies that incentivize mixed income housing developments is actually something that would reverse many of the exclusionary policies that have gotten us to this point. And a lot of the housing part is really parents using their wealth and parental wealth to buy access to educational opportunity and mobility for their children. And so right now, what we have is a system that's rationing educational opportunities through the housing market, and it's being capitalized into housing prices. So you're not actually looking at which house is better. The square footage is actually very similar, but on either side of a school district boundary, you're seeing huge differences in the price of that house, and it's all connected to school quality.
Yeah, we see
and
that so, here in Kansas City. I just note that Minneapolis just became the first major American
yes.
city to end single-family home zoning, a policy that critics say has done as much as any to entrench segregation, high housing costs, and sprawl as anything going back the last century. Is that a viable path forward? Because it's interesting, no one running for mayor or city council here in Kansas City is talking about this, even though housing has become a big issue.
Yes, and it's part of the affordable housing crisis, actually, too. And so I think that is a very hopeful first step. And I grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, so I am particularly intrigued by, you know, their leadership in moving that policy forward. And I think it might represent an important example for many other cities to follow.
High quality preschool is important. Healthcare for kids so that they can be successful at learning in the classroom. They're healthy enough to learn and understand. Before you go, tell us about Clinton, Mississippi, and how it became an academic powerhouse, because this is a good way to end a conversation about your book. And I've got about a minute left here.
Okay. Well, in the minute, you just had mentioned the pre-K. So part of the pre-K example is that the synergies between pre-K and K-12 funding, that they reinforce each other, that half of the achievement gap that we observe among third graders already existed at kindergarten entry.
Right.
And that really just highlights the early footprints of that those early pre-K opportunities. And so when we're able to intervene there with high quality pre-K, they then subsequently attend high quality funding schools through school funding reforms and integrated environments. And that in combination yields impacts that are much greater than the sum of the parts, or in fact, the effects are much bigger than the sum of the individual effects of doing those in isolation. And so part of the theme of the book throughout and the work that I'm really trying to push is that we need an integration of the actual approaches to equal education opportunity that blends the pre-K with the K-12, that blends the education with the health investments early in life, and that those are the keys. So while that's not exactly the Clinton, Mississippi example, it is, I think, the example writ large for what are the keys to moving us forward for all children.
Rucker Johnson's new book, Children of the Dream, Why School Integration Works. Professor, thanks so much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Time for a break when we come back, When Women Ruled the World. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, candidates for Kansas City's 3rd District in-district seat discussed affordable housing east of Troost, entrepreneurship opportunities, and community policing. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Next week, more candidates for Kansas City's many city council races. And join us on Friday for a conversation with NPR's Sarah McCammon, who will be in town for Radioactive. That's next week on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, once upon a time, women ruled the world. They did so from their homes in Egypt and wielded power and influence that is undeniable. And yet, history books have long overlooked this era of women in power. One reason for that may be because they were considered exceptions to the rule, little more than political pawns in a male-dominated society. Some of their names are familiar, Cleopatra and Nefertiti. Others are more obscure. But it's a time worth considering. That's why I spoke with Kara Cooney back in March. She's a professor of Egyptology at UCLA and the author of When Women Ruled the World. She joins us from NPR West in Culver City, California.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
How could the history books, Kara, possibly overlook a development like this, this idea of women ruling the world for extended periods, and yet that hasn't been included very, very much in the books?
Well, the ancient Egyptians got a jump on us, so we can't blame it all on ourselves. The ancient Egyptians would erase many of these women a couple of generations after they ruled. And if they're taking them out of their own formal history books, then you know, we wouldn't know about them either.
Why would they do that?
Well, there's this one woman named Hatshepsut of Dynasty 18, and she did such a good job ruling Egypt on behalf of her dynasty, saving the reign of her nephew, leaving Egypt better than she found it. As soon as there was another direction for this patriarchal kingship, it was easier for them to remove her name and replace it with the names of other men, to take all of her success and give it to those who came after her, those who came before her. And so we can't even pronounce the name Hatshepsut anymore.
Was there a sense of embarrassment in a male-dominated world that a woman could have that much success?
Embarrassment, you know, this is something that really gets to the heart of our own ongoing human hostility towards females in power, something that I try to get to the heart of every time I teach women in power in the ancient world at UCLA. It's something that I still don't completely understand, that I think has a lot more evolutionary biology in it than we'd like to admit. But the ancient Egyptians, like most human beings on this planet, if not all in complex societies, like to see power move through a patriarchal line from father to son to grandson. Maybe we don't all work with kingships, and maybe some of us work with democracies and more complicated and broadly based power systems, but we generally like to choose men to be in charge of our politics or our money or our religions.
And women disrupted the regular order of things, it sounds like.
Yes, but here's the cool and interesting thing. The ancient Egyptians seem to have known that women could rule differently, and that's why they picked them again and again, regularly, systematically, to act as regents for boy kings who were too young to make decisions on their own, because choosing the kid's mother or the kid's aunt would lessen warlording and competition. Because think about it, if the kid's uncle came in and acted as his advisor, then you're in a risky position. That man could come in and assassinate the young king and then take the power for himself, whereas the kid's mother's not going to do that. So Egypt trusted women to keep their authoritarian regime safe.
But what time periods are we talking about here, roughly, Kara?
That's the coolest part, too. It's from the very beginnings, from Dynasty One, all the way to the very bitter end in Cleopatra when Egypt is taken into the grasp of the Roman Empire. So it's female power is really the other side of the coin of kingship for Egypt from the very beginnings to the very end.
How tough was it for you to, you know, to go back and unearth more information about these women leaders from so long ago, particularly when much of their history had been so intentionally erased?
Well, I'm standing on the shoulders of a number of other Egyptologists who have done very careful work for these women in different times of history. I can't be a specialist of Dynasty 1 and Dynasty 18 simultaneously. These are thousands of years apart. Mm-hmm. But I rely on scholars who are very carefully checking the traces of what names and images were there before the chisels were brought to stone. And careful epigraphic work, careful examination of stones, careful gluing together of statues, these things can help resurrect and resuscitate what has been erased.
So how did it come to pass that these women found themselves in positions of such vast power? What allowed that to happen back in the day?
In each case, it's a little bit different, mm-hmm. but almost every woman finds their path as a regent for a king who is too young to rule on his own. There are situations where a woman comes to power because it seems there's no male at all, young or old. And I would put that blame, that onus on incest more than anything else. And that could be Dynasty 12 and a queen named Neferu Sobek who became king. The key question to ask is, why does a queen become king? And you probably are asking yourself, mm-hmm. well, why is she using the word king?
Right.
And I do say female king. The ancient Egyptians didn't use the word queen to connote rule. For them, that just meant a sexual helpmate of the king. The word king was used by them when one of these women attained the highest leader of state position. And so that's the word that I use.
You know, one thing I'm confused about, this notion we've talked about here of some of these histories being erased when women ruled. You know, at the time, Egypt had these laws, Kara, that created a social system that was, you know, it was more balanced, a little more equally between men and women. And I'm surprised, you know, given the fact there was some degree of parity, that erasing the traces of these women leaders was sort of the route that was taken.
Yeah, because you want to support that patriarchal lineage. And, you know, we talk a lot about propaganda today and how a government creates an idealized and perfected look to its leaders. And the ancient Egyptians excelled at this. The females came in generally during a time period of crisis, and it was that crisis they were erasing as much as the female. But I will also say that we haven't erased the females who are failures, and I would include Cleopatra in that lineage. We remember her as a cautionary tale, perhaps as a reason that women shouldn't rule. Shakespeare has written a play about her. Hmm. Everybody can pronounce the name Cleopatra and knows
right.
more or less what her story is.
Right.
And so we as human beings do enjoy keeping the stories of the women who got it all wrong and repeating those again and again. And I need to ask myself and ask all of us, why?
Well, why did Egypt evolve the way it did when it came to, you know, giving more clout to women who were seen as the weaker sex?
There's an uncomfortable truth to this as well, and it took me a long time to figure this out. But Egypt is this strange and protected place, protected on all four sides geographically, that it doesn't allow a lot of invasion from outside, and there's not a lot of warlording on the inside. And this is a place that is so interested in the status quo and safety of its kings that it develops a perfected divine kingship unlike anywhere else on the planet. And so in this most authoritarian, most unequal of social situations, pyramidal, if you like, this is where the women come in to protect that system. The more the power is held in this unequal way within the hands of a family, the more a woman can come in and act on behalf of her son, on behalf of her nephew, on behalf of her husband, to protect that patriarchal lineage. In other places in the ancient world, like Greece or Rome, where power was more broadly distributed and there was more warlording and more competition, when one man fell, another man took his place, and women had no spot, no shot to really claim real power. It was only in those authoritarian kingships where women could step in with real unadulterated power and formally take the position, at least five times, of king.
That's interesting. Kara Cooney is my guest. She's a professor of Egyptology out at UCLA, and she's the author of a book from 2018, When Women Ruled the World. How big a deal was Egypt back in those days? How powerful was Egypt across the globe then?
If we're talking about dynasties 1 through 18, or even up to dynasty 20, Egypt was the most powerful game in town. It had the best standing army. It was rich in terms of gold and other mineral wealth. And its grain, it grew easily without too much labor. It was able to grow all kinds of wheat and barley and produce beer beyond measure. It was an extraordinarily wealthy place.
So when women took over in Egypt during these different times, how did people react to that?
It's hard to say. I mean, this is an authoritarian regime. It's not like we can go to Kim Jong-un's North Korea and say, hey, people, what do you think of this guy?
How's this working for you?
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, the ancient Egyptian situation was not much different. And everyone in authoritarian regimes knows that you don't complain about your leader. We assume that people would have left traces of what they thought and felt because we're so used to what Greece and Rome have given us in terms of its political legacy. But ancient Egypt was very different, which makes my job as a historian that much more complicated because I really do have to pull the veils away from the idealized image that these kings are giving us and try to find the real story, whatever that could be.
How frustrating is that for you as an Egyptologist?
It's very annoying. People ask all the time, you know, who were the lovers of Hatshepsut, or what did Merneith think of human sacrifice in the first dynasty? And I have no answers to these things. I can hypothesize, I can surmise, but some things ancient Egyptians are going to give us answers for, but most of those human details they do not. And that's why in my trade publications, in that work, I try to humanize these ancient Egyptian monarchs as much as possible. They're human just like you or me, and we would be drinking the Egyptian Kool-Aid if we put them on a pedestal and thought of them as god kings. That's exactly what they want us to do.
How fair is it to conclude that, hey, you know, we tried this once, a world with women leaders, and we didn't go back to it, so we're slow to try it again? Is there anything to that?
I think that what we're doing now and what we're going through is a change at a very elemental level of our ideological, economic, and political systems. And by that, I mean women are slowly and inexorably taking on more power. There are only 6% female CEOs in the United States right now. Okay, great. But there are more female breadwinners, and women are starting to out-earn men in college degrees. As those landscapes change, female power will change. Women don't feel like they need to have children the way that they did when my mother was growing up, or even myself. And getting a job is not something that means you sacrifice family. And as women jump in with both feet into this world, the landscape will change. It will shift. We will allow women back into positions of power. And I often compare it to going back to our hunter-gatherer days of allowing women more equal access to power in our politics and religion.
Do we know what other civilizations thought about these women rulers?
There's not a lot there either. You know, what we do have, and this is very problematic, are the ancient Romans talking about Cleopatra in a very orientalizing way, a very denigrating way, talking about her authoritarianism in the most the most horrific of terms, and telling us how she destroyed two good Roman men, not just one, Julius Caesar and mm-hmm. Mark Antony, and twisted them with her witchcraft and her sorcery. So we do know what some Western-minded, democracy-minded, or at least oligarchy-minded people thought of ancient Egypt. And it colors our own idea of how systems of government should work. I will say this, though I'm proud to live in a democracy and I happily vote in every election, it's an interesting thing that the oligarchic system of Rome, in which power was more broadly distributed, was much more costly for its people in terms of human lives and warlording than anything in ancient Egypt, which was a much safer, more status quo kind of existence. And if people have a chance to pick, this is one reason why people choose authoritarianism over democracy.
Oh, as you look back over the rules of these different women, do any commonalities emerge in terms of the types of leaders they were and what they were able to bring to their countries?
In each case, they come into power because there is some sort of a crisis. So in each case, they're in a sense on the back foot, and they have to be, most of them, more conservative, trying to figure out what the traditional path forward might be, not throwing their weight around, not making overt claims. Now, one might say, well, that's how women have to be in the workplace today, that you can't go out there, you know, with all of this hostility, that people will then call you all kinds of words and make sure that you're seen as too aggressive, that you have to be more conservative, laugh more, make jokes, be softer in your way of using power. I'm sure these Egyptian women knew the same ways that we do, that people perceive your power, and they treaded very carefully from all that we can see.
Because you point out in here, and you just alluded to it, that these women were put into power by an Egyptian system that needed her rule, and they needed her rule because the country was having a hard time.
Yeah, in some cases, it's because the kid was too young to rule on his own. I have a 9-year-old at home. God help me if I decide to let him make decisions on behalf of my household.
Yeah.
He would love it. But no, I mean, think of Egypt being ruled by a 9 or 10-year-old kid. And who better to keep that kid in line, divine though he is, than the kid's mother? And boy, my kid thinks he's divine sometimes. So you want to make sure that woman is able to step in and keep the best interests of the child at heart. Let him grow into his kingship, not compete with him for it. It's an interesting thing to see the women who ruled for their own children. They generally didn't take the kingship themselves. They generally melted back into the shadows and let the king, their son, take it. But if the woman ruled as a regent for a child, not her own son, her nephew, perhaps, like Hatshepsut of Dynasty 18, that one step removal is enough for the competition to set in. And Hatshepsut did have herself crowned in Thutmose III's year 7, and she ruled alongside him until her death. And what he thought of this, we have no idea.
Wow. You also point out, and you've alluded to this too, that they could be seen, these women leaders, as mere placeholders for male leaders who were too old, too young to rule. To what extent does that undermine all of this?
Well, they're not there to create a legacy. I mean, let me bring up some basic biological facts of kingship. Putting a man at the center of the wheel of power makes biological economic sense, because a man can have 365 babies outside of his body in a given year with a good harem system that intensifies his biological production. That's basic biological economics. Mm-hmm. A woman at the center of that wheel of power can produce one, maybe two, if she has twins and lives through it, babies a year. And so all of a sudden, your status quo is going to be threatened. Your risk aversion is going to be threatened. And so putting a woman into that center of the wheel of power lessens your ability to create a genetic legacy. And that's the other reason these women are forgotten, because once a woman takes power, I would argue that in most cases, she is past childbearing years, or she's towards and we're talking about the ancient world, when she's probably in her late 20s, God help us all. But she's not there producing children the way that a man does, and her ability to create a legacy is also stymied by what man is she going to bring into the situation? A lover? A new husband? Well, then that man's going to take control alongside her. So like Elizabeth I, many of these women, whether they could have babies or not, pretended to be virgin queens or did not have any offspring of their own.
So was it harder for these women to hold on to power than their male counterparts?
It was harder for them not to hold on to power, I would argue, but to create a legacy of long-term power that they passed on to a daughter or a son. And without that legacy, you have no dynasty. And then the power goes to somebody else entirely, maybe to somebody within their line one step over. But that's even more reason to erase the woman, right? Because you want it to seem like it's passing perfectly in a divine sense from father to son. And this woman coming in, though you need her at the time, you've got to keep the authoritarian regime going. It complicates that whole divine succession, and it becomes easier to then remove her from the history books after her reign. It can take a couple of generations before you remove her, but if she is successful, removed she will be.
Kara Cooney is my guest. Her book, When Women Ruled the World. So let's bring this into present day realities here, if we can, Kara. What conclusions have you drawn about why societies have remained so ultimately hostile to female rule? I mean, apparently the hostility extends, at least to some degree, from Cleopatra all the way to Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, and you brought up Hillary Clinton, so I'll go there. let me make this statement that I think you can agree with, whether you're on the right or the left, that the possible lies of a female candidate are a million times more powerful than the absolute untruths of a male candidate. And the idea that a female becomes this distrustful, duplicitous person is quite interesting to me, and something that I still haven't quite wrapped my head around, though I will lay the blame at the doorstep of what we simplistically see as female emotionality. Hmm. Now, you know, these ups and downs, these mercurial perceived as female ways, you know, this menopausal woman or this PMSing woman, this uncontrollable woman, and the guy is like this even keel thing, right? Now, we've created this binary and we've created the stereotype of the female emotionality, but I would argue it's the reason that we bar women from power so systematically. And until we understand and turn that emotionality to our better interests, I think we'll continue to put obstacles in the way of the female. And by that, I mean, it's the men in society that generally rape and murder and commit violent acts. And it's the men in society who might take a gun to their family and then to themselves and go out in one big grand bang. And it's the lack of emotionality on that stereotypical spectrum that might make a man do that, lack of being in touch with emotions, that touching emotions and feeling what something might be like, connecting with the emotions of others, is exactly what we need to get through the 21st century intact.
You know, I'm just curious about, you know, this idea of Hillary Clinton. Have researchers been able to figure out exactly what the reasons were that American voters ultimately turned away from her and to Donald Trump? I mean, was it emotionality, to use your word, or was it the fact that people simply were tired of the Clintons?
I think in her case, it's a combination of both. So you can throw Hillary Clinton out of it and then look to Elizabeth Warren and look to people saying, well, you know, I like her, but I'm just not sure. She just gives me a bad feeling. Mm-hmm. I just don't know. And so we can transfer this distrust, this gut reaction towards the female to other female candidates and take the Clinton baggage out of the situation entirely. And you can look at Ocasio-Cortez and her youth and her beauty and how that is perceived as potentially threatening. So a woman can't win either way. She's seen as either too alluring and sexy and she's going to make you lose your mind, or she's turned into the crone and she's going to lecture you and berate you and tell you what to do like your mother. And there's no way to win. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I think studies on this from my own limited reading are just being done on what the psychological and sociological knee-jerk reactions are of a populace and their perceptions of females in power, and then where the biological roots of this could potentially be. I think if I go to the evolutionary biology, I see that the survival of a woman is in her nuclear family setting, where the survival of a man in a hunter-gatherer reality is in a much broader, more politically broad setting. And so I think when we see a woman saying she's going to work for all of us, then we might distrust it. We're like, no, I know you're just in there for your family and your people and not for me. Whereas the man, we might, just in our guts, in our own synapses, in our own DNA, believe it more. That is not something that cannot be surmounted. We can surmount racism, even though many have argued that that's written into our DNA as well.
I mean, although it is heartening, I've got 20 seconds left, that so many women are running this time for the presidency. It's amazing to me.
It's part of our broadening of a culture and a society, and it shows the economic and political power that women are gaining. And we'll see how the numbers shake out. I mean, I will leave it on a more cynical note that even with this year of the woman that we've just had in the American Congress, we're not at 25% yet.
Right.
And if feminism is nothing more than 50% of the population wanting 50% of the power, we have a bit of a ways to go.
That's Kira Cooney, her book, When Women Ruled the World. Kira, thanks so much. Really enjoyed having you.
Thanks for having me.
That conversation originally aired in March. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. Monday on the show, he devoted 50 years of his life to higher education. Now he's retiring. We'll ask K-State's Dean of Students, Pat Bosco, what he's going to do now with all his newfound free time. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.